This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we've got three sponsors for the show. The first is Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. The second is Jam Software, makers of the Casper Suite tool for iOS and Mac administration. And finally, Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/outofschool and enter the offer code PUPIL at checkout. A better web starts with your website. And this podcast, Bradley, how are you doing?
We are doing great. School has started.
Okay.
So we're finishing up our second day, so the plane is in the air. The only thing we've run into hiccups technical-wise is we use a program called Star Reader for kind of our reading assessment for our students to kind of gather what grade level they're on. Mm-hmm. And over the summer, the only major change I made over the summer was moving to Mavericks. So we come in yesterday, and what's happening is it's like kind of logging the kids out if they do not answer the question quickly enough.
Huh.
So get on their support, and they would like me to start opening up a bunch of ports on our network. That's okay. Always a company's like that's answer, but that's never the answer. So I'm starting to do a little bit of troubleshooting and realize that when a student takes too long to answer a question, it's sending a pop-up that says, like, hey, just confirming you're still there. Because some of these kids have longer passages to read. And So what I did is I went and turned off pop-up blocking, and it got drastically better. I still was, you know, still had the issue some where it would just fail to show the pop-up. And then, so we tried it in Chrome, and it's like 97% better.
Mm.
So then I was talking to one of our technology folks here, and she said that this is a new interface. So it's like, oh, this makes sense. This is a bug. This is absolutely a bug on their end because it's just all web-based.
Yeah.
So I have to, tomorrow, one of the things I'm going to do is get on the nice chat with their folks and try to iron out this issue. Thankfully, we only assess their reading level like four times a year. So we'll do it now, then we'll do it again in October. So it's not a huge deal. Like, cause we can make it through it. And all they have to do is when it logs them out, they log back in. The teacher has to basically type in the administrator passcode to resume. And then that's it. But again, it's more annoying than anything.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things I told her to try tomorrow is instead of doing it on a computer or a laptop to get up, like do – if we got 15 kids in the class, do 10 kids on laptops and 5 kids on iPads. And I'm certain the iPad app's going to work fine. Because I went and tested it yesterday, and it's not like it's knocking off Wi-Fi. It's none of that. It's actually just logging them out of the program.
Yeah, that kind of thing's a pain, isn't it?
It's
inconvenience for teachers.
This is the downside of like completely web-based services with no local cache. I mean, to me, it would be ideal if something like this, you're kind of all working locally, and then you push the results up.
But yeah, I mean, it's a kind of drive-by upgrade of software, isn't it? You know, we come in one day and everything's different.
Yeah, and obviously, when she told me this was like a new interface, knowing what I know about people who write software for educational products, I realized like this is just a bug on their end, and we cannot be the only one facing this. And in reality, they're probably getting inundated with support calls over this.
Yeah, yeah, they'll need to fix that.
Yeah, so I got that. And then, you know, one of the things I did the day before school started, I rebooted everything in the campus, you know, network wise. I rebooted our firewall, rebooted all the access points, just kind of getting everything nice and fresh. It's probably overkill, but it's just, you know, nice to clear out the pipes.
Yep.
And we actually just finished rolling out proximity guard badges for our faculty. So, like, some of our office staff had those last year's, like, key fobs. And we decided this year to actually, we had like basically stickers printed from a company here in town that attached to the proximity badges, and we're kind of making the policy that everybody has to wear their ID badge all the time. You know, I know bigger schools, that's like certainly the norm, but I can tell you just about everybody here's husband's name. And so it's a small staff, but just as a helpful thing for parents to know, hey, this is a person that works here. I can ask them a question. So teachers can now do that. But this is, you know, we spent a few hundred dollars buying the badges and getting the stickers printed, but it worked out well. And it's nice because they don't have to have an ID badge and a key fob. They can just have one.
One thing. Yeah. Yeah. You stick it on the back of their phone as well, and they can pretend they've got an NFC iPhone.
that's very true.
I actually saw somebody recently. One of the credit card companies in the UK, Barclaycard, had, when you have a Barclaycard, they sent out like a little, essentially the RFID chip for your card. that you could stick on to your phone with glue to kid on you had an NFC phone. It was functional. It was part of your credit card. But I actually saw somebody using it for the first time. And they've been sending them out for about 2 years, and it's the first time I actually saw somebody use one recently. So I guess that's not catching on.
This will be the year.
It's always the year of NFC.
And Linux.
It's Linux on the desktop, Android on the TV, and Apple's doomed.
And Apple's TV. Yeah, Apple's TV.
Yeah, well, I think even Gene Munster's given up on that one. So, yeah. But it is the year of the bigger iPhone, they say, which I'm quite interested in.
Well, and I think what I'm really struggling here, not struggling, but I'm pondering, is if this does pave the way for a 12-inch iPad, how does that rethink what I think about tablet-style devices in our schools?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's interesting times. I mean, hand on heart, I used to make fun of large Android phones. I really did, and I made serious fun of them, and it was actually the iPad mini that kind of changed my mind on a lot of that stuff, because although it was too small for what I wanted to do on my iPad, it kind of suggested to me, well, something with a bigger screen that runs iOS that is very portable, that could be with you a lot of the time, is quite attractive. So, you know, the more I think about it, the more I'm interested in. I would probably buy as large an iPhone as Apple is willing to make, even up to over 5 inches probably.
For me, it's still got to fit in the pocket, but I'm in the same boat where the screen size, this is a complete consumption thing, but like a lot of times in bed, I'd love to watch Netflix. Mm-hmm. I don't really want to take my iPad Air in there because it just in some ways feels too big. I know that's a first world problem, but the phone feels too small. But the size closer to the iPad mini would be more ideal. And so when you start thinking about like an even bigger iPad, is that something that's more of a niche product like that we do use in schools or that certain professions use? I don't know.
I kind of feel like a lot of weight is on iOS 8 to see if that becomes something that's viable, because if iOS 8 provides you with the right level of kind of workflow flexibility that you're used to from your desktop computer, then I think there's going to be a lot of demand for a bigger thing. I mean, I said on Twitter the other day that basically if you take a Surface Pro 3 and take out all the Microsoft, I could be quite interested in something like that ran iOS. I'm not interested in something like that runs OS X. You know, and I don't want my OS X software on a bigger iPad, but bigger iOS software on a bigger device. Actually, yeah, that's quite attractive.
And it goes back to my thinking of I don't want a bigger iPhone and a bigger iPad just to be more text on the screen. You know, let's take advantage of what we have here. You know, we have more room, so let's try to like expand what software can do, because you do have more room. Just as like when you're doing video editing on a 27-inch monitor, you can do more than if you're on like a 13-inch. You just have more room.
Yeah, there's more pixels there, so make use of them. Absolutely.
So, so let's thank our first sponsor before we get into tonight's few topics. Fine folks at Jamp Software. They've been with us for quite a while now. Got a new version of the Casper Suite 9.4. Adds some nice additions. I sat in on the webinar yesterday, doing some cool things with dual personas. You know, we kind of heard that about phones for years, but the way they're doing it on iOS is nice. Because what's really cool if you're in like a corporate environment or a school where it's like BYOD, where you can bring your phone in and connect it to the network, but they want you to enroll in Jamf to connect to the staff Wi-Fi. They explicitly say like what the IT staff can see, what they can do. It's really, really well done. So we'll drop a link in the show notes about 9.4. But again, if you don't know, Jamf software provides IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies. Includes Macs, iPads, iPhones, Apple TVs, and education organizations, and again, you know, corporate America as well. I guess the world, not just corporate America, but all around the world. Now with Casper Focus, they have placed these great technologies directly in the hands of teachers who work with students every day. So teachers, again, can use their iPad, use an iPad app to select specific Apple TVs assigned to the class. They can choose and distribute iBooks. They can even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. So again, if you want to learn more about Jamf software, Casper Focus, or the Casper Suite 9.4, we'll have a few links in the show notes. Definitely go to outofschool.net, to show 98. Use that special URL. Let the folks know from Jamf that you came to them from our show. So thanks to Jamf for sponsoring the show this week.
Yes, indeed. Just installed my 9.4 I missed the webinar, so I probably have done something that I shouldn't have done, or haven't done something that I could have done. But I at least got the upgrade done, and it was fine. So,
well, you want to get that done before the school starts, because you want to start out at least being on the latest one, because you assume you're probably not going to see another. It may be a point update between now and Christmas, but if you assume anything else that they're going to kind of wait. It's nice that they kind of get these things pushed out before school starts. And so you can kind of get them rolled out.
Yeah. I've spent the past couple of days just re-enrolling all our younger kids' iPads. I mean, we talked about this kind of at the start of the summer, and my plan, which I have done, is to leave the senior kids with their iPads over the summer. And it's been interesting because I've seen there's been enough activity going through like the smart groups and stuff I've got in my MDM to know that some of the kids are actually using their iPad over the summer. I'm seeing apps getting installed and iOS getting updated on a few iPads and so on. And I can see that, you know, I would say probably about half of them are in current use because they're up to date with they're checking in with the MDM server and so on. And there's about half haven't been used recently. So they're probably sitting about waiting to get charged up. But the younger kids, I brought their iPads in this summer and have completed now the transition over to managed distribution for all of these iPads. And it took me 2 days to start to finish that job. Finished it this morning, or finished it this afternoon rather. And so far, so good, I think. What have I seen? I made 60 Apple IDs in 1 hour using my Keyboard Maestro trick. We were joking a couple of weeks ago, Bradley, about whether or not one needs to get whitelisted in order to do that kind of thing. The answer is yes, I did need to get whitelisted anyway, because it turns out that it's not just your IP address, but it's also the email domain that you make the Apple IDs from. So they were seeing all these at cedars.inverclyde.sch.uk Apple IDs is getting created, and I got blacklisted after about 10. So I had to get a little exception for that.
How did you know you got blacklisted?
Well, it just stopped working. I mean, I made one, I made two, I made three, four, five, and then when I tried to make the 10th one, it just said, please contact iTunes store support. It's like, well, okay, that's the ban hammer coming down. And as soon as I heard from my solutions engineer people that they had whitelisted the domain, it just started working again, and it worked for 60 after that, so it was good.
So how was that process? So I guess, did you have to unenroll them and re-enroll them into the Casper suite?
Yeah. I mean, basically what I did was I unsupervised the devices and reclaimed all the software licenses from them back into Apple Configurator. So, and that just erased the devices. So I left them basically erased at the end of the school year last year. And I deleted all those device records out of Casper. And when I came back to it this week, what I did was I re-supervised the devices in Configurator and used the new features in the latest versions of Configurator to skip some of the setup screens. You can now skip some of those setup screens. And also what I did was I put in our GSS enrollment URL and certificate into Configurator. And what that does is it puts a step in the setup assistant that says, Cedar School can configure your iPad. Do you want to accept that configuration? And what that really means is, do you want to enroll in the MDM? And you just hit accept configuration and go. And it, as part of the iOS setup assistant, enrolls in your MDM. So it's kind of like a poor man's device enrollment program. It's not enforceable in the same way that DEP is, but it made the setup process a lot simpler. Well, so having done that, I had to then go and configure 60 iPads by hand, which was a pain.
Yeah, well, the inline configurator enrollment is definitely a time saver, no matter what kind of deployment you're doing. Just so you can, if you've already got them supervised and you want to leave them supervised in configurator, but you still want to get them in Casper Suite, you just drop that configuration profile in there, and then you're kind of off and running. It does it automatically. I'm working on an article talking about this, but really, really enjoying the smart groups in Casper. And just being able to have at a glance to see, okay, these are all on the latest. Okay, these have checked in. These are all on campus. Everything's got the latest profile. It's really, really a neat section.
Yeah, I mean, one of the side effects of being able to have an individual Apple ID per device is that all of our devices now have Find My iPad turned on, including the youngest pupils, which they never had before because they didn't actually have a functioning Apple ID on the device. And now they all do. So Because I made the Apple IDs and I know the password for them all, I could, you know, log in to find my iPad on the web, on my computer for any one of those devices and make it ping in case it got lost inside the school. So that's going to be quite useful too.
Did when you were making these Apple IDs, did you create email accounts for these individual accounts, or did you do like an alias within Gmail for some of them?
Well, as part of this process, I discovered that you can only have about 25 aliases on one Gmail account. So what I did was I used plus addressing. So every Apple ID is of the form. It's got a certain a word beside it plus and then a serial number after that. And that I just used a macro feature in Keyboard Maestro to just increment that by one every time I made another one. So they're all of the same form and they're all numbered so that I kind of know who's got which number of account. So even though the account's not personalized for the student, I can at least say, well, Apple ID 35 is this student here, because I've got that in my sort of student database information.
Well, it seems like it was a pain to kind of do, but now that it's done, you're set up forever.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, in some ways it felt a wee bit like going back a few years, back to the days when you'd have to set up every iPad by hand in the first place. It's one of those things that the privilege of being in a small school is you can just brute force that. And I can sit there for a day and just, you know, literally go through the setup assistant 55 times for 55 different Apple IDs. But now that I've done it, and I can just use that. And I think what it's going to get me, it's going to get me a big win in terms of maintenance over the course of the school year. So instead of like me having to sit and install apps onto all these different iPads and different groups of iPads through Apple Configurator, I can just change it on the MDM. And whenever a teacher wants a new app, I can just hit the button and it will automatically send those apps to those devices. That's going to be really useful.
No, yeah, it's long-term, this will save you a lot of time because you're, yeah. I mean, do you even need Configurator anymore?
In the sense that you need it to supervise the device in the first place. But beyond first time setup and activation, I'm not going to use Configurator with those devices again. I was going to say one other thing about that. Yeah, one of the things I discovered when I was using Configurator over the past year was that I had to somehow sort of separately maintain a list of which classes had which applications, because Configurator doesn't let you create a playlist of apps or anything that you sort of sync onto a set of devices. Every time, say, like a pupil in primary three broke their iPad and I had to give them a new one, well, I had to then remember which apps were primary three apps and turn them on for all of those, for that new iPad, and install only those apps onto that iPad out of the list of all the apps that I've put on all the iPads in the whole school. And one of the ways that it's going to be easier now is that what I can do is in Casper, I've got these VPP assignments where you can say this group of students get these apps. And what will happen is whenever I have to replace that device, once I get that device enrolled and assigned to that student, their Apple ID will bring back the same apps again. So I don't have to check and uncheck 100 boxes to make sure the right apps go on for that student. That's actually that data, that list of apps that class gets is actually going to be represented in the MDM server and will sort of be automatically applied. Or say a new student comes into a class, I just put them into that assignment group and they're going to get the same apps as everybody else gets. Which is going to be great.
Like, I've got my Configurator database organized into groups, and there's like a K3, K4, K5 first grade, a second and third list, a fourth and fifth list. Mm-hmm. And if I plugged a iPad in and moved it to that group, that would then, you know, they're like, if I click on K3, K4, it only has the apps checked that are supposed to be on those iPads.
Huh.
It's like on the left. If you're in the supervised pane, the window.
Why did I not know that?
There's a plus button on the bottom left. Oh. Like it says all devices, USB connected, yeah. And then it has groups.
See, my practice was always just to click on the ones that were USB connected and then just manipulate that group from there. Huh. I had no idea that that was kind of, you know, the groups were, the app assignments were supported.
And so what you can do, preserved. What you can do is kind of make your changes in each individual group.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if I make changes in the K3, K4 group, I hit refresh and then I can plug. I have a USB hub that has six powered outlets on it, and so I plug in six sinks, six more sinks, and then I do like the final, you know, six more. Then I do the final one or two to round out that group, and then it dings when it's done, and I know that K3, K4 is done, and then you know, it's not asking to refresh anymore. And then I can go to like the next group and hit refresh, and it's asking for those, you know, make the changes. And so that's why you could actually have a different, if you wanted to do that through Configurator, to have a different configuration profile based on the grade. So if you didn't want to have the camera enabled on, you know, kindergarten and below, but you did on first grade and up, you could very easily.
We should have done this show a year ago. It would have saved me a huge, big, massive spreadsheet in Google Drive.
Yeah, this is like, that would drive me nuts. If I had to do that manually, because like we have like a complex, like ours are the same way. I have this like list of 80 apps or whatever, and then like each grade it gets usually wants about 20 of them.
Yeah, I mean, I knew you could make changes, say like, you know, the never update iOS setting or something like that. I knew you could change that, and it would wait for the next appearance of those devices in order to make the changes whenever it sees that device again. But I did not know that apps were. The list of selected apps was handled in the same way.
Yeah, like if I click on all devices, on the majority of apps, it'll have a dash in the check mark, letting me know that like some of them...
Some are and some aren't. Yeah.
Yeah. So, interesting.
Well, there you go. Let's forget everything I said. we'll fix this after the show and take it 20 minutes of
consideration. Well, but the thing is, it's obviously not intuitive because you've spent enough time in Configurator that if you didn't know, then there's certainly somebody else that doesn't know.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely.
So some person listening to the show right now is like banging their head because they've just done that and then school's already started.
Yeah.
It's like,
it's so painful.
We also just rolling out some new math curriculum. It's from a company named McGraw-Hill, which I think they own everything as well.
They're pretty much everything to do with everything.
So we rolled out a new math curriculum, first grade and up, and like second grade or third grade and up, it's like a digital component as well. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's a whole other system. So you have to we had a master teacher account, and then I created the other teachers' accounts, have to import the student database. Now, apparently they do import from PowerSchool. Did you know that PowerSchool used to be owned by Apple? I did not know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Yeah,
crazy.
Did they ever do anything with it? I don't think so.
Sold it, basically. Should have kept it. That would have been nice to have an Apple ran SIS. Maybe we wouldn't complain as much. But so they work with PowerSchool, and then in their in McGraw-Hill's defense, Renmo doesn't have an API, so they really couldn't. Which that should be fixed one day. But so I had to basically create an import spreadsheet that imported all of our students. Had to create, you know, each student a username, which is annoying in itself. That just give me a Google login and I'll create them Google accounts. It's just very frustrating. So, but the downside is the usernames had to be unique to their entire system. So it's not even like our data was siloed off.
Yeah.
So like I had to do J Smith BBS for every student name.
And then reverse DNS name for every student.
Yeah. It's like, you know, come on guys. But again, it all works fine. You know, they have an iPad app. Parents can access it from home. Teachers can assign content for them to work on at home, and teachers can review the work. Like, that's all fantastic, and it all works fine. Except it's another login system. And you know, somebody sent me a tweet of a company that's trying to fix that, be like universal login. But the problem is, everybody wants to be the universal login. I'm sure, because I mentioned this to our trainer. That's like we're just sick of like having, you know, five logins for every big curriculum we have. She said, well, you just need to buy all McGraw-Hill. I mean, that's actually a great point. I probably should. Be easier.
And that's when the meeting was over. You threw them out.
Well, because what that does is that if you do that and you say you get in bed with like a McGraw-Hill and say, we're using everything you got. Yeah. The problem with that is, are they always the best in every subject and every grade? And they're not. There's other things that are better.
Yeah. No, that's the pain of these things, and in some ways it's one of the reasons why I kind of I don't want to say I like textbooks, but I kind of like not having to have a system for that kind of stuff. You know, there's a system in Scotland called Scholar, where a lot of this stuff that they have on their website is still kind of based on things like Java and Shockwave and so on. So I haven't looked at the newest stuff yet, so it may be different, but even up to last year, that was a lot of what they had. And it's because in Scotland, the Scottish curriculum, the Scottish education market is pretty small. So it's not like there's 20 different companies producing textbooks for every part of the subject. It's in a lot of cases, you've only got one option, and it's whatever's just there. So, yeah, use the computer like a pencil, not like a book, right?
Yeah, I'll complain about the logins, and probably until I die. I mean, when I think that our parents, they've got a login for our tuition system, our student information system. Our fifth graders have email addresses, which I just created today. Mm-hmm. They've got one for our reading comprehension program, and now they have one for math. And they literally have five logins from us. And I probably need to include a copy of 1Password for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the best thing you can say about that situation is that it's quite resilient to failure. You know, if one of those systems goes down, you're not broken for everything, you know. Whereas if you have something that's kind of overspecified, like a learning management system where it's one thing for everything, and if that thing goes down, you're really stuffed. You know, so resilience, perhaps.
If only all these systems use Facebook for logins, the problem would be solved.
Facebook's absolutely reliable, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, and then it wouldn't. I mean, that way everybody could know how you're doing on all your schoolwork. We wouldn't need report cards because it would just always be there. You know, make an F on a paper goes in your timeline.
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of not having a good privacy law that you don't have in America.
It's not even we don't have a law. It's like we got nothing.
Yeah,
good times in America.
Yeah, we would go to jail for doing something like that, probably. Yeah.
Before we move on, let's thank our second sponsor of the show, the fine folks at Shobi. Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can quickly and easily assign and collect and review student work on their iPads, and then they can provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes, and voice notes directly on the documents. Students can show their learning by submitting to Shobi from thousands of compatible iPad apps or by completing assignments with Shobi's built-in tools. Shobi keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email, and push notifications. Now, Shobi Basic is free, so teachers can go and find the download link at outofschool.net, and you can get started with your students in just a few minutes. So, again, that's at outofschool.net. Now, Shobi is offering a special deal for listeners of the show. If you buy Shobi Pro for 5 of your teachers, they will give you an extra 5 teachers for free for the school year. So that's 10 total teachers and all their students on Shobi Pro for a full year for the price of 5. So if you want to learn more about that, go to shobi.com/out of school. That's shobie.com/out of school for more details. Thanks to Shobi for sponsoring the show this week.
All right. What are we up to now? What are we talking about?
Clothes. Dress codes in schools.
Dress code, right? Button down collars, the whole bit.
One of the things we kind of been tinkering with for the last few weeks, and it's really obviously hot news, is wearables. And we would be wrong to assume that this is not something we're going to have to deal with in the next 2 to 3 years. I would think, especially in the high school level, I think this will be something people are really going to have to deal with. And I really see it being one of those things like cell phones where we teach schools just don't want to deal with them and don't know how to deal with them, so they just get rid of them.
Yeah, I definitely think that wearables are – well, it's not even the case that they're on the way. I mean, wearables are here, right? People are buying them. People are sort of not buying them, but people are trying to sell them, I think, is probably the best you can say. And it's a whole area that I think is going to be very interesting in terms of not just – like we can focus on the policy response from schools as one aspect of the whole transition towards computers that are much more personal, portable, and, you know, separated into components, if you like. Does that make sense? Instead of it being that there's a computer on the desk and that's my computer, the computer is now actually multiple endpoints to some cloud service probably or something like that. And I think it's not just about the policy response, so it's also about the educational value or otherwise that these things can bring to the school.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I hope we've learned from how we treated cell phones in 2000, 2001, that these things are tools. And it's irresponsible to just dismiss them. Imagine if people were like dismissing the iPad. So you can't bring your iPad to school. Why not? No. It's a computer. Can we not bring computers to school? That you've got to kind of think outside the box and think, okay, this is a new technology available. How can we use this to further our mission? How can we use this to help students engage and learn and comprehend faster and, you know, retain it longer?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing I want to say about this is that I think it's even already clear that wearables are not just one thing. And I think I kind of get frustrated, and you've heard me get frustrated about it, Bradley, that people tend to kind of focus on the idea of tablet computers, like talking about using tablets in schools, as if all tablets are equivalent, and also as if it's the tablet aspect that makes it what it is. And I really kind of disagree with both of those aspects. That, okay, you know, we've brought the iPad into school, we find it very effective, but it's not because it's a tablet. I mean, the tablet form factor gives you a couple of advantages, and it gives you some disadvantages as well, but it's actually the software, right? And it's what it can do, and it's the battery life, and it's the integration of the cameras and the microphones and the Wi-Fi and the touchscreen and what that opens up. It's not just the fact that it's a flat computer that really makes a difference. And I think one of the traps that we could fall into thinking about this is that because you strap it onto your body or you wear it on your face or whatever, that it's that somehow makes these a different thing. And I don't know if you've seen this, Bradley, but I've certainly seen it where, you know, people come from education and they look at something like a tablet computer and they think, well, a tablet is different from a desktop or a laptop, so we have to basically start from scratch and we have to try and understand from first principles what a tablet is and what it's good for and stuff. And I kind of look at it more like it's just another kind of computer. And in some ways it's a better computer, it's more secure, it's more stable, it's easier to use, it's all these things. But it's still a computer, you know, and I think often too many people look at that kind of thing and they say, well, a tablet's a whole new thing and we have to evaluate these from scratch as if they're not basically just computers in a different shape or box. Right. I think there's an interesting gap in the middle there, but still in all, it's still just a computer in a box.
Well, you've got to step back and look at a 40,000-foot view of technology computing and say, what does this allow me to do? Because yeah. It's like let's look at the car industry. They're all getting us the same place. Like, it's all about point A to point B. It doesn't matter if it's a motorcycle. It doesn't matter if it's a tank. It's all transportation. And so if we look at computing and say the goal of computing is X, it's to take notes, it's to research, it's to communicate, it's to use for to store documents. If you say this is the goal of technology, well, all technology does that. The Dell you had in 2004 does that, and if it still ran, it would still do that. Mm-hmm. But when you look at, you know, you look at what each device is, the strength of it is, and then you have to weigh that with your mission and what you're trying to do. So certain devices are better for certain things. You know, if you say, all right, we're starting a class on film editing, and you want to teach Final Cut 10, well, I don't think you're deploying an iPad Mini for that.
No, probably not.
And it's not, again, that the iPad Mini is bad. It's just not the right tool for the job. So you just got to step back and look at, say, technology as a whole and computing as a whole from a 40,000-foot level. And it's when you get lower to the ground that you start kind of seeing the differences. And I think you're right that wearables are just another wrinkle in that discussion. You know, again, this has nothing to do with education, but you look at like the GPS running app. So I use an app called RunKeeper when I run. My doctor told me to start running a little bit more, so I started running a little bit more. Well, would a smartphone that could store that data and then sync it back to my phone, would that not be really better because I don't have to carry my phone with me? Mm-hmm. Maybe it could even hold a few songs or a podcast or two on there. Maybe the latest episode of Out of School I could re-listen to. That's a joke. But, you know, you look at just like the job the technology is asked to do and what's the best thing for it to do. And you can see the place where in the classroom there can be certain kind of devices that could be the worst device in the world for the task, but it could also even be better than the iPad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's important to be quite nuanced about this, and I think it's in some ways it's too early to have this show, but it's also the right time to have the show because people should be thinking about their policy response to some of these things, but it's too early to say what that policy response absolutely should be, because I think the wearables as a category and as a concept is still quite poorly formed. I mean, what kind of wearables have we seen so far? We've seen a couple of smartwatches, the Pebble, the ones from Samsung and so on. We've seen Google Glass. We've seen, you know, fitness tracker bands and things like that. And even already, I think what's interesting about it is that they're not all the same thing. right? That something like a Nike Fuel Band or a Jawbone Up or one of these things, those are very much what you might call sort of devices that are in towards the phone, right? So they kind of depend on the phone, but they provide data to the phone. Whereas you look at something else like a Pebble Watch or Google Glass, they sort of take the phone and they almost kind of break the phone apart into separate components, right? So I have a Pebble Watch, and my Pebble provides like a secondary screen for my phone, and some data gets forwarded from the phone to that device, and the same thing with Google Glass. And I think there's possibly a case for thinking about these things in almost sort of subcategories of wearable, that just because you put it on your body doesn't mean it's all the same thing.
Well, and there are going to be things that we'll never have any idea that the students are even wearing.
Well, I think this is where it goes, you know, and eventually there's going to be, at some level, there's going to be implantable versions of some of this stuff. You know, I mean, already we have certain medical devices for fixing certain kinds of deafness, for example, that are actually built into people's heads. You know, you get, I forget the name of it, it's like a cochlear implant or something like that, where there's a kind of sensor that's actually on the outside of their head and it's wired into the ear. I don't know. It's a completely basic description of how that thing is put together. But, you know, that's an early example of something implanted in the human body that enhances someone's abilities beyond what they naturally are.
Well, we have, in the past, have had students that have insulin pumps, that they, mm-hmm. you know, have diabetes and they have to have insulin pumps. And yeah. So obviously now it's got some electronics in it, but you could even see in the future where that thing's all automated and it can tell what you eat. And again, is that not a form of wearable? Absolutely. Just, you know, does it have to have Twitter on it to be a wearable? Does it have to, you know, have a social feature? I guess you could do that. You could post your insulin results to Facebook. I don't know.
That's going to be a thing, isn't it?
HealthKit. Yeah, HealthKit. You're right.
You know, I think, sorry, I was just going to say that. I think that one of the first fields for this is going to be those children who do have acute medical conditions are going to have digital components. You know, you've already seen like the smartphone insulin meter and things like that. You're going to see a lot more. I think that may be the first area that you start to see it come into the scope.
We take our fifth grade camping trip every year. We, like, 2 years ago, we had a student that had an insulin pump. And I think the mom was obviously very, you know, if I had a parent of a student that had an insulin pump mm-hmm. that was in fifth grade, like, they're at the age where they should be able to manage that somewhat with the help of the, you know, adults. But if you're a parent and you've always dealt with it, it's a little concerning. So imagine if he had some way that it was automatically done, could tell what he ate, and it could just manage his insulin for him, doesn't have to think about it, and could record those results to like either a phone that we allowed him to bring, or maybe we could even connect it to one of our phones, and then could somehow share those results with his mom. Like, that's pretty incredible, or even his doctor.
And this is the kind of thing that, you know, you can't take his phone off him. You know, you can't have him hand it in at the start of the day because that's a critical thing that he needs to have with him at all times. You know, if you had something like that was connected to a phone.
Yeah, again, it's not just about fun. It's about, you know, actual real life and death kind of things. And, you know, imagine if you had, a student that couldn't previously take physical education with some sort of device could allow them to manage it and take that class. Well, then again, that enhances the learning process. That, you know, if we are concerned with the students, you know, academic and spiritual and physical well-being, well, there's a part of where we're able to help with at that point. I think you're right that most of us at this point, when we think of wearables, we're thinking of the Fuel Band and Google Glass and the watches, and it could potentially be drastically more than that. And it could also be something we just can't manage because, again, you know, we can tell what Google Glass is now, but what if that's in a contact lens?
Yeah, or even in a pair of glasses. You know, it doesn't even have to get as sci-fi as a contact lens for it to become a thing that is incredibly difficult to challenge whether or not you should have it. Because this, I think at some level, this is the kind of question that's going to arise with wearables that has not yet fully arisen with either smartphones or tablets or computers, is like, at what point do you get to enhance your biological body with technology and then legitimately use that in the purpose of education? Because you know, the examples we've given so far are things like, insulin pumps and the things to kind of keep, to put it at its crudest, to keep a child alive while they go to school. Nobody's going to argue with you on that, right? Medication for children who need it, nobody's going to argue with that. But children who are deaf, children who have short sight, I mean, what is the number one wearable technology in schools right now? It's a pair of glasses, right? And I would argue that if you don't think that's wearable technology, then you should probably go back 1,000 years and see what it was like before they invented glasses. And being born with short sight, as one of my daughters was like a, I don't say a death sentence, but it was a severe impairment to your ability to learn because you couldn't read in the same way that people who had proper sight or full eyesight did. So the question next becomes, well, what about people who are notionally quote-unquote normal? Do they get to use technology to make themselves somehow more than that? And where do you draw the line on that?
And you could do an in-app purchase for, you could download the book into your brain.
Well, I mean, where does it end? You know, do you get to wear a pair of glasses that show you certain things over the top of what you can see? You know, or what if you could take a pill that just gave you 40 IQ points over what you were born with?
In that purchase for an early copy of the test?
Well, you know, I mean, how far down does this go? I think this is just such an interesting thing to think about. You know, if you could say you could take a pill that gave you 40 points of IQ, and that pill cost $100,000. What happens then? Does everybody get the pill? Does the government just pay for everyone to have that pill? And then what's the point in having the pill if everybody just goes up by 40 points? Only the rich people get it?
What if it's like the Matrix where they can say, all right, we're going to give you jiu-jitsu skills, and they could just download them? I know this is really far out there, but if, let's say you could take a pill and they give you all the knowledge that you ever need from all of primary and secondary and post-secondary college, school. And again, going back, maybe it costs $100,000 for all of that. You can take one pill, you're good to go.
Still cheaper than going to Harvard.
Still cheaper than school, but is going to school just about what you learn?
Yeah. Well, this is the interesting thing, and I think as it goes beyond just like making up for nature's deficiencies in whatever way we might describe that, and it becomes about enhancement, how far do we let that go? I mean, already you can buy tools like calculators that allow you to calculate numbers far greater than you can do in your head. Okay, and we still not really even resolved that question. I know I keep going on about this because I still care about it, that, you know, we have this situation where the way we've resolved the existence of a small box that can compute numbers much faster than a human can is that we have one exam where you're allowed to use that box and one exam where you're not allowed to use that box. And we still haven't even decided whether or not we should use calculators for mathematics in schools, really and truly.
And nevertheless, that if you look at our jobs, when in your job do they say, all right, Fraser, shut the laptop, figure it out from scratch? Never. Right, exactly. Yeah. And so I agree with you that we've not figured that out. We've not figured out, is math the ability to do it on paper, or is math like the ability to know how to calculate it on a calculator and actually had to mentally work through that problem? Because the calculator, you don't plug the problem in the calculator and you record the results. There's still, you know, things you must know about how to organize the question. But you're right. We've not solved that. And that was a problem when I was in school. I'm sure that's still a problem today. And it's not changed. Yeah. I remember we had the graphing calculator that you could play Mario on. You could load. Yeah, we would load games on. That was great. It was like the silver one, TI-83+. I guess it's probably still out there. But it's like we're still having these same discussions on, is that learning if they use a calculator? You know, are they tested the same? Nevertheless, the fact that in their working world that you can use all the technology in the world to solve your problems. It's always, you know, whatever you can do to solve your problem, do it. We just care about the results. And do we feel that way in school? It's all about the results, or is it about the process? Because in business, it seems like it's about the results.
Well, it's funny. I think we sort of claim that it's about the process, but we actually only care about the results.
Yeah, there's no E for effort. It's A, B, C, or D, or...
Yeah, true that.
Before we move on, let's thank our final sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Squarespace. Again, Squarespace has been with us often on this year, so we appreciate them sponsoring the show. As you mentioned, they are the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own website, online portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com/out of school and use the offer code PUPIL, P-U-P-I-L, at checkout for 10% off. Now, Squarespace sponsors a lot of podcasts. We've mentioned it on past shows. They love sponsoring podcasts because they love the medium, but they wanted to do something a little bit different with their ad reads. So they hired Jonathan Mann, who is the Song of the Day guy. He created a viral hit like a duet with Siri and We've Got a Breakup and also the iPhone 4 song. So he made a song about Squarespace. So again, we'll listen to that now. Thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring the show this week. Again, use the offer code PUPIL at checkout for 10% off. A better web starts with your website. Every device, every time, all the options you need to create a unique website. They're constantly improving the platform and the tools, and it's awesome. Squarespace, get started today. Make a website that you want to make. Squarespace, so easy and fast. They fund all your favorite podcasts. They fund all your favorite podcasts.
So, I guess, you know, that's a lot of the kind of sci-fi stuff that we've talked about, you know, what happens when we can pay to grow a tail and things like that. But what are the kind of immediate term consequences of so-called wearable technology in schools? Are there any? I mean, I think what you're going to see pretty soon, in fact, if not already, is, you know, kids are coming into school with like wearing a Nike Fuel Band, for example. Does that seem like something that schools should have a definite policy position on? Not sure. What would you think?
Well, I think I look at the question, does it create a classroom disruption? Mm-hmm. And I think you start with that question. And if it doesn't, then who cares? It's 2014. Yeah. And why do we care if a kid has something around his wrist? I'm wearing a little rubber band around my wrist right now. You know, they do those for fundraisers. I'm wearing one right now. It doesn't cause a distraction. Why would a Fitbit cause a distraction? No, if I'm, you know, running around the classroom, waving my arms, trying to get my steps up, well, then that's a behavioral issue, and you set your butt down. But I think we've got to step back with this stuff and let it kind of unfold and just ask the question, like, what's the classroom implication today? If it's causing an issue, we deal with it. But I think we deal with it not that we ban everything, but we just deal with that situation. If one kid makes a call in the middle of the class, they don't ban cell phones from school. They deal with that kid.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is partly why I'm kind of against thinking about wearables as a specific category, because I think they're going to be so disparate that, you know, if we say, well, we don't allow any wearables in the school, and then you get the kid who needs the insulin monitor, well, he gets an exception, and then this person gets an exception, and this kid who's struggling with their weight gets an exception for their Fitbit, and so on. But at the same time, you're going to see devices like, for example, you know, some of the Samsung smartwatches, which have got a tiny little camera in the wrist strap, you know, and what impact does the behavior on that, around that, have on other pupils in the school? Does it have an impact on their privacy? Does it have an impact on teachers' privacy as well? Things like that. You know, there are questions to be answered there too. And I think in some ways a lot of those ships actually have sailed, because a lot of kids are going to be carrying phones with cameras already. And, you know, the trick so far has sort of been to say, well, keep it in your bag and that's okay. You know, it's kind of like drinking out of a brown paper bag. You know, as long as it's in the bag, it's okay. But I think what's going to happen with some of these wearable devices is going to be an end run around some of those sort of social compromises that we've made in the classroom about, well, you don't take your phone out in class. Well, what if the phone is part of the phone is on my wrist? You know, the camera and part of the screen is on my wrist. Do I have to take that off when I get into the classroom? And so on and so on and so on. I think it's going to be a very difficult field. I think it's going to be a hard one for people to just get exactly right.
And, you know, what happens when, you know, we had a situation here in Chattanooga recently where someone put a pen in a restroom at a restaurant that had a camera in it and recording people coming in and out of the restroom. Hmm. Well, what if a kid, you know, videos another kid in the restroom and puts it on Facebook? You have to deal with it. And again, I don't think the answer again is to ban it. I think you just have to deal with the issue, and kind of take them on a case by case basis. And you know, I think the thing that I really worry about is cheating. You know, that if you're trying to take a test, and again, not that, mm-hmm. again, that kind of backtracks what I said before about being able to research and things like that. But if you do have a test, an English test, where you've got to answer questions about a book, you don't need to have the ability to open the book on the Kindle app on your in your glasses or your contacts.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it, you're right, and there's going to be a window of opportunity for cheating, I think. I mean, on my Pebble smartwatch, I have access to Evernote. So one of the ways that we normally deal with people bringing smartphones, like, because kids travel to our school and they have to have their phone for travel or wherever. So we normally like impound their smartphone as part of the sort of procedure of going into the exam room, and they're taken off somewhere else and so on, shut down. But if you had a smartwatch that could communicate over Bluetooth to that phone, then how long is it going to be before, you know, exam invigilators start to wise up to the possibility of somebody's watch actually having an entire Evernote database on the watch? You know, I think eventually that might become the case, that that will become part of the procedures, but there's probably an opportunity somewhere in the middle there for people to try it on a little bit and see how far they can get.
Yeah, and you know, I remember we had this vocab book when I was a senior, and this was 2002, so the internet was a thing. It just wasn't as popular as it is today. Mm-hmm. But like, I'm going to be real honest with you guys. I Googled the answers. I hated these vocabulary books, and I don't guess I Googled it. I guess I like AOL searched it or whatever the search engines were.
But AltaVista'd it.
Yeah, AltaVista'd it or dogpiled it or something. And other people had like put the results on the internet. And like, it was a standardized book. It wasn't anything unique to our school. And like, I literally found the answers on the internet. And then I shared those with others. I was not a good student back in the day. I was a good student, but you know, I did shady things like that.
You were a good internet citizen, I think.
Yeah, like it's just that and Napster and selling burnt CDs. Oh, it's a terrible person.
A lot of sharing.
But yeah, so I did stuff like that. And that was in 2002. And I was a good student. And I was tempted to do things like that. So what happens when you get a kid that, I mean, you can imagine if you've got contacts in taking an exam, you could snapshot the exam and share it with the next class.
And especially if it becomes something that is kind of conflated with something that's medically necessary, right? So the glasses is a sort of simple example, but later the contact lenses, well, A, do you even know I'm wearing them? And B, how can you make me take them out when I need them to see, right? You can't actually make me do that because then I can't see the exam paper to read the questions. So it's going to be a really interesting and tricky one. I mean, I think, you know, let's leave that to one side for a minute and think about, well, what are the benefits of it, right? Because there are going to be benefits along with it as well. And I think there are great opportunities to use wearables in school, but they're probably just not going to be quite the same as the ones you think of when you think of wearables down at the Apple store.
Yeah, this is one of those where when we saw a tablet back in 2004, we didn't envision what it could do in schools in 2014.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I don't know that our mind has wrapped around all the neat use cases that could come. You know, the market does excite me. It really does, as long as we can kind of like, you know, figure out some through these like cheating things. But I mean, I always think about when I was like in school and kids would get mono and they'd be out for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't care if they get the work or not. You miss everything that's in the classroom. Imagine if you could like send them a pair of Google glasses and they're virtually in the classroom every day.
Yeah, I mean, so maybe the augmentation technology that we use in schools is not so much a Fitbit or a Pebble watch, but it's a telepresence robot for somebody who lives in a rural area and can't get to school all the time or something like that. Maybe it's a telepresence robot for a teacher, and then there's just a security guard or something guarding the school and the children. But one of the things I think of just as a simple example, just to get people's minds kind of thinking about this, is in a lot of pro sports now, the players wear a sort of GPS location tracker as they play the sport, and then there's software that can analyze the team performance afterwards. You see it in rugby, for example. I saw it in hockey at the Commonwealth Games recently in Glasgow. And I think footballers are even starting to use it now as well, where basically it's a thing about the size of a USB stick, and they wear it. There's like a pocket at the back of the neck or something like that, or on the chest of the sporting uniform, where that gets inserted in. It's unique to every player, and then the coaches can kind of capture the data and analyze it actually in real time, because they use it in rugby during the game. The coaches are sitting there looking at laptops, seeing who's performing well and who's performing badly. And I think some wearables like that could actually be some of the most interesting first applications in schools as well.
Yeah, you think about baseball. You know, I played baseball in school, and I used to, like, in 2001, 2002, my parents would use their, you know, crappy camcorder, and we would record it, and I would watch my swings back, and it was, you know, it was obviously terrible angles and things like that, and you would try to analyze my swing. But they've got great iPad apps for that now, too, where you can, like, film it on the iPad, and the coach can mark up your swing and kind of, like, an explain everything for sports.
Yeah.
And but imagine if you had, like, contact glasses in that recording, you know, what you're seeing and, you know, things like that. And you could kind of, like, analyze, you know, where you're seeing the ball at, look at the break, how the breaking ball comes in. And this is all, like, incredible stuff that we would never thought about 15 years ago. But it's in the realm of possibility in the near future that could happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's one of the things that I see a lot when I go to schools. And the app you refer to is an app called Coach's Eye. And, excuse me, one of the things that I see with that is that the PE department is one of the first departments in the school that really gets enthusiastic about using iPad to kind of enhance the performance of the students there. And you can just see how much better that could get if it becomes wearable, the ability to do that kind of analysis.
Yeah, it's exciting. I mean, I think we could see a lot of cool stuff in science classes, you know, how you do experiments, and you could watch them back, and you could kind of, maybe if you had to do a discussion about your experiment, you could watch it back again and see what happened, and you could analyze it further instead of having to go back just from your memory. I think you know, at the end of the day, I see more good out of wearables in schools than I do bad. And I see a lot of good. I think it can take what we think about computing with the iPad, how it's simplified, and it can be so integrated in with our, you know, daily lives in the school, that wearables can take it even further.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also going to pose an interesting sort of integration challenge for schools, because I think what you're going to see with at least the first several iterations of wearables is that they're going to be very much like the iPod, in the sense that they're an extension of a much larger computing system that you have to have, you know, because, and partly that's because, you know, like when the iPod came out in 2001, you couldn't make a smartphone. You couldn't make an iPhone in 2001 because, you know, the components were too expensive or too large or too power hungry or something like that. So we could build a simple thing that could at least be loaded onto with FireWire and could play back from its own internal hard drive. And that's the best we could do. And I think in some ways, the early wearables are going to be a bit like that. You know, the Google Glass is dependent on a connection to a smartphone. You know, various other things are going to work a bit like that. But I think later on, you're going to see, you know, you could imagine, after maybe 5 or 8 years of development, that a fully autonomous version of Google Glass is much smaller, lighter, the battery lasts a whole lot longer, and it's actually got its own SIM card in it as well. You know, that could become a thing that we see as well. And at that point, maybe it's more easily deployable, whereas, you know, fitting everybody out with wearable technology right now could be a bit of a pain in the backside, because you'd end up doing a lot of pairing and a lot of erasing and things like that, and we don't have Casper Suite for Google Glass just yet, so it'll be a fair bit of work to say. But that's the way it always goes, right? I mean, iPad wasn't easy to deploy 4 years ago. iPhones weren't easy to deploy when they were new as well. But they'll get better, and I think it'll be interesting to see how long these wearables stay a part of an existing ecosystem and how long it takes for them to sort of become their own thing in their own right. Like the iPod went from being the iPod to essentially being the iPhone and becoming its own ecosystem. It'll be interesting to see how long that takes.
You know, is your contacts the center of your digital hub? You know, we look at the phone as kind of like the center of everything now, because it's the one you always have with you. Does it become your glasses? Does it become your ring? You know, who knows?
Well, I wonder if the phone doesn't just become like the brick in the pocket that actually provides the connectivity to everything else. You know, just with the experience of wearing the Pebble Watch so far, which I really like, it's reduced the amount of things that I take my phone out for. Not by a huge amount, obviously. You know, you can't watch Netflix on your Pebble Watch or whatever. But in terms of, you know, notifications and so on, it's actually the first screen I look at before I look at the phone. And it's become interesting to see just how that, how your relationship with each part of the system changes as you add another thing to it and another thing. Kind of going back to the discussion we had at the start about what will the impact of having a larger phone be on your tablet use, and what will the impact of getting possibly a larger tablet be on your computer use and so on. Well, what's the impact of getting a smaller screen as well? Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about that, if the phone becomes a real brick, that maybe it's like literally like almost like a hotspot in your pocket. Think about the battery life, and then of course, then you've got 9 things to charge. But do you even need a screen that you can touch, or is it all, I don't know, in your face?
Well, that's a question. But the different kinds of wearables that we've talked about, you know, the ones that are providing data to the phone, do they even need a screen? Well, most of them don't have much of a screen, if at all. You know, the fuel band's got a very basic screen. Some of the other trackers have only got status lights and things rather than an actual full screen. So it'll be interesting to see just how that kind of works its way through. If you're just gathering more and more and more data from your environment and feeding it into individual phones, what does that mean for things like privacy, but also how can you instrument your world in order to do analysis or to look at different bits and pieces of the way that your system works, the way your classroom works, and what can you actually use that for learning? It's potentially quite interesting.
Yes, indeed. I think we could be, it's like you wonder, are we at 2004 with wearables, or are we at 2010?
I feel like we're much closer to the beginning. I really do.
I do think too.
There's a lot of kind of failed experiments so far. You know, I've had a fuel band before, and it broke, basically. That was the problem with it. It wasn't robust enough. And we're in the Pebble now. It has a lot of useful features, but for example, it doesn't support emoji. And if somebody sends me an iMessage with an image in it, I can't see it. All I get is a blank message. So a lot of these things are not working together very well just yet. And I think it will become much more powerful when you start to see things designed explicitly to work together from end to end, giving like the full experience on the device. In the kind of way that the iPod gave essentially as close to as could be achieved the full iTunes experience on your mobile device. You know, you had the genre and the artist and the album menus, and you could drill down the way you would actually do in iTunes as well. It was essentially like a tiny little iTunes in your pocket. And if Apple's smartwatch becomes iMessage on your wrist, that could be pretty cool. It really could.
We shall see.
But only if it supports GIF.
And emoji.
Yes, GIFs and emoji, and I'm queuing up for that. So yeah, I don't think we've resolved anything about this whole topic, but I think it's one that's worth bringing up, because I think it's kind of the next frontier of the cloud actually kind of becoming far more dominant. Do you know, does that make sense? Like, how am I relating this to the cloud? Well, I think that the smartphone, the tablet, the computer, those are all now endpoints for cloud services. And I think what's going to happen is, as I'm already starting to sort of experience with Evernote on my watch, that's another endpoint to cloud services. And then it'll be, you know, Google Glass is obviously an endpoint for things like Google Now and Maps and so on as well. And I think you'll start to see that just break apart into more and more little things that can have a bit of your cloud experience in different ways, some more limited, some less limited, in lots of different components. It's going to be harder to know where, you know, where is a computer now, in the same way that you don't know where like a microchip is in your house. You got a microchip in your washing machine, you got a microchip, you got probably 100 microchips in your car, 1,000 maybe, microchips in your watch, in your oven, all over the place. You don't know where they all are. Pretty soon you're not going to know that about, you know, full computers either. And that's going to be an interesting time when it comes to school.
Yes, very much so. It'll be fun a decade from now to, if we're still doing the show, the episode 5,000, that I mean, we can reflect back and, you know, probably recording this with probably sitting next to each other virtually, having this conversation next to a fire.
Yeah, we'll just be talking, and all our words will just be getting recorded automatically.
Yes.
Yeah.
You wonder, like, how far is it to, like, where a baby could be born and every bit of their life is recorded?
Well, I mean, you can actually compute the cost for that now. I mean, it's not outside the affordability. There's a book called Total Recall by a guy called Jim Gemmell, who was a researcher for Microsoft, and I forget the name of it, it's called like Lifestream or something like that. They had this research project at Microsoft where he designed this kind of like bat belt thing, which had, you know, old in the olden days of the 90s probably, batteries and hard drives and things, and it was his intention that he could actually record all of his life on his device that he was building. And, you know, obviously it never became an actual product, but people have tried that, and, you know, it's not infeasible. I mean, it's probably been possible for quite a few years now, at least financially, if not in terms of power consumption and convenience. It's doable.
Have to read my photo book then, if you're going to do that. Got to have them organized.
Yeah, I mean, you think you've got a problem with data storage and photo management right now, my goodness. Yeah. And I imagine one of the hard problems with that is actually just getting anything back. You know, there was a time when something happened. You know, I've seen this guy before somewhere. When was that? You know, trying to wind back like 25 years of every word you said and find out when you last talked to this guy.
And then by that point, you'd be dead.
Yeah, well, the storage and retrieval is the hard part, isn't it?
You spent 50, you live 50 years, and you spent the next 30 years rewatching the last 30 years.
It's like that movie though, with the guy that falls in love with Siri.
Yes. Still asleep. Still watch myself asleep. In the shower.
Cool. Well, let's leave that image with the listeners. Okay, so we'll catch up again next week, Bradley. We're actually back next week. Next Thursday we're back, so we've got a couple of days of in-service. I've got a little bit of iTunes U update to do for staff, because we've also got iTunes U 2.0, which I'm looking forward to using as soon as we go back. So I'll let you know how that goes.
Sounds good. I'm Bradley Chambers on Twitter, and on the web at chambersdaily.com.
And I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web. And we'll talk to you next week.